All right, you should have your Bibles once again open to Romans chapter 12. Now we're ready for verses 13, 14, and 15. Yeah, three verses. I don't know. It's kind of like one doctor said when he was sewing up a wound. He said, they asked, how many stitches will I have? He said, you'll have as many as when I get done stitching. I know, but it shouldn't be too bad. We do have some interesting stuff in this, though. This one's a little bit different. And if our understanding appreciation is what I got out of you at the end of our last session, therefore, I guess it's with confidence that I can say both you and your father should be confident and satisfied with having this information from verse 12 written on the table of your heart, and so you're ready to move on. And therefore, verses 13, 14, and 15, as we saw way back when we first introduced the entire section that makes up our instruction of wisdom, we identify that this is the fifth component to the Son's instruction of wisdom. And this is what it says. In your Bibles, it says, distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality, bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not, rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Well, I don't know how much time you spent reading ahead or looking at this, but some things should be a little striking about this that should cause you to see that a bit of a shift takes place here once again. And we're going to talk about that shift. But as we said last time, the thing that we are to really be doing right now before we get all involved in this, in verses 13, 14, and 15, and I get kind of excited because I have to turn my page in my Bible, which means that I've only got one more page left, and I see the end of the book of Romans. So, it's a page turner. All right. One of the functions that we really have to expect that takes place at this point, before we get into any real detail, is I'm coming to learn a little bit more about the pre-doctrinal exhortation. And it's kind of a combination, at least the way I'm going to do it and the way I teach. And it's really something left to the pastor, it's left to the bishop of the assembly to do. We kind of have to craft our own pre-doctrinal exhortation of these things. And really you're going to find your exhortation, much like we did in the last one, in the introduction to this. And then some of the things that we introduce about it that now dovetails off of the post-doctrinal exhortation we just received back there in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. One of the functions of a pre-doctrinal exhortation is for a father to come along and make his son aware of the earnest and really dire need to get this next thing going, to move on, to move forward, to not just stay where he is, but to get the information he's about to be given. On the positive side, that's what he's going to do. You've got to, you're not dealing with a child. You're dealing with an adult son who you're training into your business. And you want him, before you even say any of the words to him that makes up what he's going to get, the body of information, you want him to have a dire need for it, to see the need to get the information. And that's kind of the positive side of it. But at the same time, he makes his son aware of the foolishness that there is if he doesn't get it. And that should become even greater in our minds because we see now how verses in God's Word don't just stand alone, but they comprise components that make up a grander form of doctrine. If you don't get it, if you miss even one of them, you don't have the entirety of your Father's wisdom. And that's going to be a big deal because you're not going to be able to make decisions properly. And so you see, you make a son aware of the foolishness that it is if he doesn't receive his father's instruction and respond positively and properly to it on the negative side of things. So pre-doctrinal exhortations have two edges to them, or two sides to the coin. One is a positive side of making the son aware of why he needs this, why it's the next natural thing, why it's the next in order of a sequence that he needs to have to get the bigger picture, to have real strength and have real power, real ability and real capacity, without which you're just a pretender, without which you're just an imitator. You're not the real, genuine thing. You're not a genuine son. There's a lot of pretenders out there. And then on the opposite side of that coin is to make him aware of how foolish he would be if he doesn't receive this and respond to it positively and properly. Therefore, I know you're here in Romans 12, but come back to Proverbs chapter 1 and get your eyes on these verses. This is why you have such things being said to the son in the book of Proverbs. Come back up, flip back to the first chapter of Proverbs very quickly. Chapter 1, begin there in verse 7. The fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. You think you'll find that written over the top of any school of philosophy in this country? That those men don't even have knowledge without the fear of the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, Jehovah, the God of the Bible, the only God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. My son, hear the instruction of thy father and forsake not the law of thy mother, for they shall be an ornament of grace unto thy head. Remember that? That's going to be your promotion. Your promotion depends upon it. Chains about thy neck. That's why you get information like that at the beginning of your sonship life. On down in verse, look at the one of the, where there's a paragraph marker there, verse 24. He comes along and he says, as he ends the chapter, because I have called and ye refused, I have stretched out my hand, but no man regarded. This is the other side of that coin. But ye have set at naught all my counsel, and would none of my reproof. Do you think there's going to be consequences to this? Yeah, they're going to be adult consequences. You read the consequences of this, it goes right over a child. A child reads this, When you're an adult and you read this, it shakes you to your bones. Look at what he says. Ye have set at naught all my counsel and would none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh. It's interesting that he talks about that fear issue. When your fear cometh as desolation and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind. Now, I know this is said for Israel and Israel's program, but there's consequences. There's sonship adult type consequences. When distress and anguish cometh upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me, but they shall not find me, for that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would none of my counsel. They despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of the fools shall destroy them. But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely and shall be quiet from fear of evil. Yeah, there's consequences to all of that. That's why those things are said to the son. That's that kind of exhortation that makes that son aware that everything I'm teaching you, son, regardless of how you imagine it to be, is critically important. You've got a dire need to get it. Without it, you're going to be incomplete in your understanding and your ability to make decisions after a godly manner. That's why you get, look at how chapter 2 opens up, just the first five verses of it. You know these verses well. My son, if thou wilt receive my words, this is the commitment issue, remember? And hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart. Listen, this church, this assembly should never ever have to have ever again a sermon or a lecture. You should never have to be lectured by me again for attending class. And by the way, I'm not going to do it. You're either here or you're not. But the fact of the matter is, we're past the point that you're attending here honestly. Incline thine ear unto wisdom. Apply thine heart unto understanding. Yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. And that's what you're supposed to be after. That's what you assented to when you cried, Abba, Father. Well, by now, you should be very familiar with these things. What I just read, you should be so familiar. In fact, it should just be second nature to you by now to hear something about that earnest and dire need for the upcoming information. That's not to be a surprise. It's not to be surprising when you read there in verses 13, 14, and 15 what you read or what it's going after. When Paul talks to you there about the way in which you're to be hospitable, or when he talks about distributing to the necessity of saints, when he talks about giving to hospitality, not just being occasionally hospitable, but being given to it, bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not, rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. You should be able to think your way through what started up in verse 3, and you know that godly wisdom is being instructed to you by your Father's words. It's being done in a manner in which He's using an issue of His godly love to teach it to you, because nothing in God's thinking, in His character and essence, in His being, is more powerful as an aspect of decision-making skill than what He values and what He esteems versus what He doesn't value and what He doesn't esteem. And therefore, godly love is the manner in which you're going to be taught His wisdom. Well, you've gone through some things, four components of it by now, and you have some structure to those four components by now. And you should be able to think, well, I know if I had the 3x5 card, I might not come up with the exact words, but I would say that before we get done with wisdom, we've got to address something similar to what is said here in verses 13, 14, and 15. You should almost come up and expect the next natural thing to be brought up. And if you don't expect it, you should be able to read verses 13, 14, and 15, and within a little bit of time spent thinking about it, really thinking about it, be able to see at least an obvious reason why that would be the next natural thing to come up. Which, if that's not in your thinking, the exhortation, guess what it's going to do? It's going to make you aware of it. So nobody's left out. Even those of you who say, I could think on this all day long and I still don't see anything. Well, the exhortation is going to save you. That's why a father exhorts his son before he gives him another component. And also a basic understanding, and you should be also familiar with at least a basic understanding and appreciation for why that's the big issue. And that's what we filled in here, and we'll fill in when we put number 5 up here. We've already done it, but for why you're being told the things you are in the upcoming information even before you're told it. Well, as you get along in the curriculum, and we are getting a little bit along in it, there's another important function that a pre-doctrinal exhortation has, and that it also functions and is designed to function. Now watch this, to come along and countermand the effects of the policy of evil and its attempt to come along and neutralize or stop your progress as a son. And this is very critical, because we've just come through two segments or two components, component number 3 and component number 4, which has you in a hostile environment. It may not be as hostile as it will be, but it's still a hostile environment. And that is, you're in the world at large, experiencing having to live as a son in your job and in the rest of the time that you spend out in the world at large away from here. And so I think it's fitting to talk about this now, that this other aspect of an exhortation, pre-doctrinal exhortation, is to settle the son's mind as to what he's about to receive and how that is going to encourage, excite him, and produce godly type enthusiasm to get it. And so that you're just, give me, give me, give me, give me. I can't wait till I get this type thing. You're straining to get it. You're champing at the bit to get that, because you recognize its power and its might can countermand the effects of the policy of evil's attempt to come along and neutralize you or stop you in your progress as a son. And as we go on through the rest of the curriculum, these exhortations begin changing, and they take on the nuances to encourage, exhort, so as to accommodate the nature of the attacks of the policy of evil that we face as sons and daughters. Well, therefore, when this is done properly, when it's done properly, as we go through an introduction and the pre-doctrinal exhortation, it should, as we've always talked about, it should prime your inner man. You can either think of the priming as priming a pump to get going, or as I often talk about it, like primer on an automobile to receive paint and make it stay there so it doesn't just flake all off. But it primes the inner man to make it ready to receive the information you're going to receive, so that that information sticks. It has staying power, whereby once it gets written on the fleshy tables of your heart, it does become the permanent and sensitive, always looking issue part of the book of your soul. And that's really one of the things we're going to try to accomplish as we go through these exhortations. Also, in view of the efforts of the policy of evil to stop your progress, which is almost theoretical right now, but it'll become more real as we go on, the pre-doctrinal exhortation should make it so that no matter how much pressure, no matter how much opposition you're under, to generate the capacity to keep moving forward in spite of the pressure, in spite of the opposition. What is the only way that you can fail? If you give up, if you quit. And that so easily rolls off the tongue. Or you might easily be able to say at one point, you know, this is so great, I'll never quit. You will quit. I guarantee you, you'll quit. If you haven't properly been through those five probing questions, if you haven't properly been established as a son, I guarantee you'll quit. You'll quit. In fact, you're going to be so, it'll be so easy to make you quit that you couldn't possibly imagine how easy it would be. That's why the most important thing up to this point that I've ever done in this church in the 20 years I've been here is what we accomplished in Romans chapter 8. I know it's the most important thing that was accomplished in my heart after my justification. And sometimes it comes down to having to think and concentrate about just keep moving on. I want to give it to you in an analogy, in the terms of a Navy SEAL. I had this information come across my desk the other day, and I read it, and my jaw almost hit the ground as to how closely it resembles what we're going through. And as some of you know, a Navy SEAL is a special forces individual. Do you know what SEAL stands for? Why they're called SEALs? They're not called SEALs because they're cute, cuddly, and they go, art, art, art. They're called SEALs because the word SEAL is an acronym. You know what it stands for? We'll get to that later. I don't want to get off on a history lesson. They used to be, I'm not going to do that either. You can do that for homework. Go look up what the acronym SEAL stands for. You got sea, air, and land. You got involved in all of that. This one Navy SEAL, though, in an interview, said the following. His name is Richard Mankiewicz. And I want you to hear the way he expresses the kind of training that he went through and see how it parallels what we're talking about. Quote, he says, "To achieve success really comes down to one thing. How bad do you want it? How bad do you want it? There's no magic formula to it. It's just the consistent progress or moving forward toward the thing you want to do, regardless of whatever thing comes up." And I call that thing that comes up quitting. Now, I'm going to stop quoting him and interject my own comment. For a SEAL, that's the worst possible thing. As a SEAL who's a member of the elite special forces, you're chosen. You have to go through a screening process that's unbelievable, and it's an honor just to be chosen to try out for the SEALs, to go through what their school is called BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition School. But the only thing you have to do to stop the pain and the training and all of that you're going through is simply ring a bell. At Coronado, they've got a bell, and as the school term goes on, when one will quit, that bell means I quit. And he takes his helmet off, which has his number that's assigned to him, and he lays it down, and as one after another quit, those helmets start piling up right under that bell. So he says that thing is what I call quitting. That quitting conversation will show up in 100 different ways. You can say to yourself, "This is crazy. I can't believe I'm doing this." Or you can imagine things like, "I'm just not good enough. I'll just never get this," or whatever. But I'm telling you that in the fight, quitting sounds very reasonable. That was one of the greatest lines that he said. In the fight, quitting sounds very reasonable. It's a very simple process of getting on target and moving forward versus the conversation that leads to quitting. When he's talking about conversation, he means in your own head. And those conversations show up every day for people. And really, that's the battle. That's the war. The majority of people who get selected to SEAL training will quit. The majority of them will drop out or simply go away. You've got to be able to generate within yourself the frame of mind you must always have to be going forward. You've got to want the thing bad enough to be willing to do anything to get there, regardless of, and in spite of all obstacles, in spite of all hurdles, in spite of all the doubts that get in, the stress and the pain, you've got to keep going forward toward the target. I know he had no idea, but we've got a target. That's our hope, that we're moving constantly toward that. He goes on to say, it's very binary. You're either going forward and accomplishing, or you're not. It's very clear under pressure, under stress, under doubt, under hesitation, under pain, under intense fear, to make that clear decision. You're either going forward toward the target or you're not. It gets all the excuses out of there. He goes on to say, I'm telling you, quitting is very reasonable. I can have a million reasons to quit. But can you find the one reason to keep moving forward? And literally by saying, well, I'm going to keep going until I die. As long as you're still breathing, as long as you have a single pulse in your body, you can still go forward. I think it just makes it very easy to distinguish whether you're going forward or not. He goes on to say, under stress and pressure, you think about doubt. And it's just self-doubt. I think everybody has doubt. Everybody has those things that occasionally creep in. I don't care how strong you are. You've still got to be able to go one step further. And as long as you can breathe, you can still go one step further. You're not dead. And so I live by the axiom, not dead, can't quit. That's his axiom. Not dead, can't quit. He says, I got a quote that really drove me forward when I was trying to get ready for the SEAL team and getting ready for Bud School. It's a six-month course that people get badly injured in training. We had four broken necks, broken legs, broken arms in my class alone. It's a severe, intense course. And they have this thing everybody knows about called Hell Week, in which about 80% of the participants fail. I think we had a class of about 140 people, and eventually we finished with 23 or 24 graduating. That's a significant drop-off, especially considering the screening process you had to go through just to qualify for the class. He says, I was 150 pounds soaking wet at 6 feet tall. I was desperate to have some kind of an advantage, some kind of a thing that would give me an edge. When the going was bad, I needed something to keep me going forward. I was fortunate to have a friend whose brother had made it through SEAL training. I don't know the guy personally, but what happened was he sent me a picture, and on that picture was his platoon jumping out of an airplane. It gave me a visual representation for what I wanted to be able to accomplish. But more importantly, when I turned the picture over, there was this quote. On the back of this picture was this quote that said, a man can only be defeated in two ways, if he gives up or if he dies. That radically shifted where I was ever going to go from that day to the day I die. A man can only be defeated in two ways. He gives up or he dies. I carried that quote with me until the ink disappeared off the paper. And that's the end of his quote. Or the end as far as I'm going to quote him. That's the Navy SEALs. But folks, your Heavenly Father and His Word, the Bible you hold in your hand, was 2,000 years ahead of the Navy SEALs. You have a target. Your Father placed in front of you. It's to be placed as your Father's son, to be seated there with Him in a position of rulership in the heavenly places. That's your target, to liberate the creature from the bondage of corruption. That's your target. Man, I want to tell you something. You may not realize this, and I don't realize this because I wasn't involved in it, but I've heard it firsthand, how disappointing it is to spend all the blood and the lives to take a piece of land only to give it back to a group of people who will no more know what to do with it than when they had it in the first place. And that's something that our military has done over and over and over again. That's disheartening. When you or someone has died to get that piece of land only to give it to the likes of people who will never be able to do with it what you could do with it. Folks, that's the world's system of conquering and the world's system of war and victory. That's disheartening. You don't have that. You have a Father who, when you liberate the creature from its bondage of corruption, it's never going to be repossessed by an adversary. It's never going to go into the hands of somebody who doesn't want to know what to do with it, or who will do with it something that doesn't even approach the sacrifice that was made to get the thing in the first place. Your Father sacrificed His Son so He could have you as His brother or sister to work in that place with Him and do that. He didn't die on the cross just so that Christians could sit around and have a nice Sunday morning so that it makes their Sunday afternoon meal go down better. Jesus Christ did not die for the majority of what goes on in the name of Christianity today. He didn't die for that. He died and redeemed so that you would receive the adoption of sons. And you and I have got a target to be conformed to the image of Him, to become a joint heir with Him. In a word, you have, let's not use the word target at all. Let's use the word our Father uses. You have a glory. You have a hope that's so grand that nothing compares with it. And you have a double enemy, yourself and the adversary, Satan himself. And from these enemies, you and I are going to encounter all kinds of resistance and opposition that's designed to make it so that you do one thing: quit. It's all you got to do, ring the bell. All you got to do is quit. But as long as you and I are alive, your Father has given us the ability by the effectual working of the power and the might of His living Word living in you to keep moving toward that target. That's the importance of getting the next component, and then the next component, and then the next form of doctrine. Now I want you to think of that between now and Sunday. That grand hope and the power and might of His Word and His curriculum for your sonship education to work together with any and all opposition and resistance that you may encounter that comes your way, and work it for your good, for your benefit as a son, whereby you and I get to experience something that no Navy SEAL, not the toughest Army Ranger, not the most skilled Green Beret, no military personnel, no special forces, Delta personnel of any kind either has, can, or will ever experience by their training. Our training provides for us to be more than conquerors through Him that loved us. Theirs doesn't. Even by their standards, some of their victories are hollow. Ours never is. And that's the kind of dire need, the kind of desire that a son is to have, the kind of longing and confidence to get a skill set that will enable you to do as our Apostle Paul says to Timothy later on: fight the good fight of faith. The idea that you could go to 1 Timothy 6 and verse 12 and talk to anybody intelligently about fighting the good fight of faith, meaning that they go to church a lot of times and they support all of the programs and blah, 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 blah. That's just a bunch of garbage. It means nothing. They're not fighting anything. They're fighting boredom. That's what they're fighting. They're fighting straw men. They see Satan around every corner when Satan has them completely enveloped and they don't even know it. They wouldn't know Satan and his tactics if it fell on them. Fighting the good fight is what a son does. It's a good fight of faith. It's not the good fight of the church bazaar. And folks, you should be thrilled tonight. You should be delighted to be receiving from your Father wisdom. Goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. Goes all the way back to the beginning. The greatest contention that has been the contention of all of history: whose wisdom is going to prevail? Your Father is saying, I'm going to give it to you. My wisdom and the skill set of being able to make wise sonship decisions by the time you get through that sixth component in every area and every detail of your life. You've been trained by the wisdom of this world long enough. Even if you're a child in here tonight, you've been trained by the wisdom of this world long enough. You're not getting just any old wisdom here. You're getting the wisdom of God. And that's the kind of enthusiasm, the kind of approach this exhortation should give you for this fifth component to our instruction of wisdom. Well, we're going to stop it right there. I think that's enough for tonight. What we're going to do next time is begin to develop the introduction to this, which will culminate in the exhortation as to why is this the next natural thing. But between now and then, I want you to look at verses 13, 14, and 15. And I want you to think for a moment when you look at those that there's a alteration. I was going to say there's something peculiar, but it's not peculiar. But there's an alteration that takes place here where I want you to think for a moment about, let's make this real simple at first, the godly thinking. Because this verse starts off with you doing something. As you read that, it's almost like the godly thinking is missing. Well, you know it's got to be there. And it is there. It's just not stated. I want you to think about all of this in total. And think about what is that. When it comes to godly love, you know that godly love has to be the core of this. We know that godly love is selfless and kind. But if you were to put a name to what this is that could fall under godly love, I want you to think about what that is. Because when we find out what that is, that's the thinking that we're supposed to have. It's been naturally generated. It's already in existence. You may not know it, but it's already there. But think about, if you were to put one word to that, what is all of this about when it comes to love? And I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. And we're going to make sure that we nail it down to, I'm sure you're going to have great answers, but we're going to nail it down to a particular term our Father uses when He describes His love doing things like that. So if you want a hint, take a look at passages in God's Word where loving kindness is talked about, because that's what we've got now. And in and around that loving kindness, you're going to find God describe it as He does things with the nation of Israel, and He has a particular word that He uses to describe it. Now there's 30 instances, so have fun. They're not all that hard to find. But there's, just off the top of my head, you might, I think, if I'm right, there's two times the word loving kindnesses is used, and they're used in one verse in Isaiah 63, and you'll find it there. So we'll stop right there, and we'll pick this up then on Sunday, and we will continue with our introduction and pre-doctrinal exhortation to this fifth component of our instruction of wisdom. With our heads bowed,